Hello and welcome to a December edition of season four of the Mic'd Up Show, where every mortgage has a story. This is the ultimate hub where the hidden stories behind the mortgage industry come to life. My name is Michael Kelleher.
And happy holidays. My name is Michael Zhao.
And in every episode, Michael and I dive deep into the entrepreneurial spirit, the strategic insights, and the breakthrough innovations that built the world's greatest mortgage companies. So whether you're advancing your career or scouting industry leaders like John we have today, or exploring opportunities in fintech and prop tech and wondering how mortgage or home ownership on the other side of the chasm is relevant, you're in the right place to find out. So get ready to unlock the story behind every mortgage. Today, we have a special guest for me, S. John Murray, who I'll be calling John throughout today. And he and I have crossed paths. When I created the mobile app, I would find myself running into him at the MBA scene, at Lenders One and other cooperatives in the 2014, 15, 16. Now, we've had other people on here that you could say the same thing about, but very few were from Massachusetts. So very few were just a stone's throw or, you know, a couple miles or a train ride away. And so anytime I would see John, we'd have sports. The local teams were doing pretty well during that time. So we got to know each other really well. I would call him when I had a new idea. I had an idea at the time. We were white labeling mobile apps, and we knew we could really get to the next level if we just made a commercial app that loan officers could download that we didn't have to white label for the company. And we made this app called Loan Squatch.
My favorite.
And John loved it. I mean, all the buttons were like Sasquatch footprints. So like Loan Info was a Sasquatch footprint. And the app in the store was called Loan Squatch. We own loansquatch.com. John, like, would, you know, he's an idea guy. He was like, you need bumper stickers. Like when I go up to skiing, you know, you see him. And so, John, we're going to go through your story, but it's one of the backbone of this show, which is once you get great at sales and being a great loan officer in this industry, if you stay focused on that, the opportunities come to you and you get a chance to grow. But at the same time, you kind of all live through the same pattern. So we'll go through that, some old technology, you know, new technology time, becoming old, winning awards and awards that aren't over anymore. John actually said it funny to me. He said, that is my life story. I don't know how you got it all on GPT, but I don't want to be some obituary. I got to refresh a little bit of it because it sounded so commemorative, right?
Hopefully you can hear me because I just lost you for 1 second, but you came back. So you can hear me okay, right?
Yeah. So why don't you tell us, before we all dive in with our questions, before we dive into how you in Michigan went into the mortgage industry, can you just explain a little bit about just how you're feeling about where you are in the mortgage industry today and who you are and why you're energized, especially with the Synergy One team?
Oh, I've gotten re-energized. It's funny how the origination business is so the same, but so different than what it was even, back in the 80s. It's crazy how, in some of your questions you came up with, it's funny because you don't know what technology you miss until you don't have it. And we did a short stint. Draper and Kramer was my old company, great company. I wanted to retire there. They ended up stopping the origination kind of system and selling off the company. So we went to a smaller bank that wouldn't allow even ChatGPT.
Wow.
I mean, we couldn't have Gmail. We had no hybrid e-closings. We had no portal to help the clients log into their applications and give us, their documents. So everything was done by somehow I had to figure out how faxes worked. And it was unbelievable so I had to go from a system that was so easy with technology to one that we didn't have for the last year. So we're so happy to get back to Synergy One. I mean, they're exactly our old company on steroids, not the bank company, but the Draper and Kramer mortgage company. It's amazing that technology and the ease that my clients are so happy to be back to have this. And I'm ready for it to get busy again because it's just so many new toys to play with. I'm psyched. It's reinvigorated me.
I wanted to start. It's the holiday season here. I'm going to go over my cousin's for Christmas Eve, and he's going to pull out a CD that I burnt you know, with my mortgage information on back in 2012, and I thought I was creative. But then I read, you know, doing the research, you have a 2004 holiday CD on eBay branded A Holiday Journey, Volume 2 with S. John Murray from Mortgage Financial. So can you just give us a glimpse into the era of sending physical gifts and handwritten notes and music to clients?
I thought having a CD was so ahead of the curve then. You know, I was going to go with a cassette, but I figured, no, CDs will never go away. But we would send out these Christmas CDs, and it was awesome. I mean, my clients, except that it started getting in 2004. I mean, 2003 was huge as far as production goes. So it got expensive because I had like 1,000 clients that I was sending these CDs to. And I'm not the most organized person as far as getting Christmas cards and things out. That's putting it mildly. So it may be that was the one thing I had to get ready and get ahead of the curve to do and get those out to all my clients. Because if I didn't, I would hear from them. I got a lot of crap from my buddies, though, that we were like, oh, thanks for sending me your Christmas holiday journey, you know, and all that. But it was the best marketing piece. It had my picture on it. And they you know, and then again, I couldn't send it late because you're not going to listen to I'm Dreaming of a White Christmas in January. So it had to go out and get to their house. But unbelievable. Like, they just waited for this thing. And I had to keep on remembering which ones I didn't send. I did it for like 6 years. So it was a whole group. I met you too late. You would have been on my list. I was going to have my son bring it in. I wish I did because I still have them. I have to dig out the CD player, though, so I can play it.
Wow. John, let's go back in time, back into the 80s and start with your journey. I think, or even maybe even earlier than that, I'm not sure. But if we can trace you back into your days into Michigan and really talk about your start in sales. Would you be on tell us your story of how you got into sales and what you did in order to start your hustle or your journey of the hustle?
It's funny because through college, I learned that the easiest way to make money was waiting on tables. And so it gets overall. I think all the best originators probably start out as waiters or waitresses or in bartenders because you get to learn to talk to clients and not be nervous about it. And so, because I'm not great with public speaking or any of that type of stuff. I just never was. That was not what I wanted to do, but I didn't mind talking one-on-one with any of my clients. And so when we're at Michigan, there wasn't a lot of opportunity in 85 when I graduated and getting into 86 for any type of a job. So the only one that came out there was American Frozen Foods from Woburn, Mass. And I didn't want to stay in Michigan. I mean, I don't know if you've been out there for any length of time, but it's flat. There's no ocean and there's no skiing. Or there is, but it's actually a mountain that used to be a dump that they put snow on. So that's your skiing out there. So I was coming home and so I got into sales. Unbelievable training for American Frozen Foods to learn how you flash freeze meat so they don't, you know, you don't break the blood vessels and the type of cuts and boy, I'd sit down with a family and I'd you know, you can get this with fillets and, you know, all the different London broil cuts and the different hamburgers. And we'll even throw in a couple of turkeys, which I hate asking for referrals because they had to give me like 10 referrals and I get a turkey. They get a free turkey. That part of me is tough. I have a tough time asking for referrals from my clients because I'm afraid I'm actually like the American Frozen Foods guy just saying, I'll give you a free turkey. Wow. But then I would go through the whole thing like, wow, what does this cost? I'm like, well, it's $70, you know, a week, but that includes the freezer. And they'd be like, oh my God, that includes the freezer. So I had like I would sell these things like crazy, but we wouldn't get paid until their credit checked out. So I had like a 90% sales rate, but only about 50% ever got delivered because half the clients couldn't afford the actual $70 a month when they ran their credit. So
that's almost better. That's almost better than a mortgage ratio now, actually.
No, it was crazy, but you know, I did not want to. And the funny thing is they told me how much money you would make. And at the time they said you could make up to like $35,000. And I made the Mr. Meat probably list 3 out of like the 6 months I was there starting and I was training people. I'm like, look, if I'm Mr. Meat and I'm only making maybe $1,000 a month because of all the different, you know, my friends love the Mr. Meat thing. That was another one that got me. But anyway, I realized this wasn't going to be a career I wanted to stay in. And it had turned out to be a little bit, the meats were unbelievably expensive. I started doing the math out and they're back then it was like $30 a pound. I'm like, wow, this is not something I feel comfortable. Like, you know, I finally got to the point where it was one of my good friend's wife's family. And the guy, they were older. They're like, oh, we trust you. We're going to buy from you. I'm like, no, I can't do it. You can't buy this stuff. It's way too expensive. So that's when I went to interview with Farragut Mortgage in origination. And the rest is kind of history. It was crazy.
Can you tell about that first year of transitioning into mortgages and then going from brand new? Back then, you didn't need an NMLO license. It was if they hired you, you became an originator. So what was the first week, the first month, the first half month, and then all of a sudden going from brand new to all of a sudden running an entire branch in a year?
Well, that was the crazy part was, you know, I didn't even know how to spell mortgage. I have a tough time spelling mortgage right now, but I had no clue to get into it. So, but I was extremely lucky. I worked for a company called Farragut Mortgage. And at the time when I started, they were the first, the day I started basically, I think it was that week, we were the first company in the country to break 10%. And you would have thought we're giving money away. So I was training with my loan officer friend who became my manager, who then became a stockbroker afterwards, but he did $14 million the first month in February of 86. And I think it's 93.7. Can you imagine how many loans that is? All by hand, all by those little, we had the white, the pink, and the yellow sheets that you had to sign for your applications. It was crazy. Yeah, they pressed through. Yeah, you had to press through it. And I always forgot the wrong. Oh my God, I took the pink one, not the yellow. And it was always like crazy. But so my first 2 weeks, I did $6 million in loans. I thought this is insane. And I was getting 55 basis points. So I made more in 2 weeks than I would have made what they lied to me about making at American Frozen Foods, which is just, I thought this is never going to end. This is the best thing in the world. My family thought I was working for like drug dealers. They're like, you can't make that kind of money. And then, I did learn quickly that a lock loan is a closed loan, because then Gaddafi in April of 86 or 80, yeah, it was 86. He bombed the palace and killed like his daughter, his guy, and two of his sons got in, and oil spiked like crazy. And so we had rates go from, you know, 9.99 back up to 11.5 really fast. So, but it was we were all happy that happened, because none of us knew what we were really doing. And it took like 4 months to close those loans, but they did eventually all close. So
during that time period when rates went from 9 to 11.5 back in the '80s, technology is super antiquated compared to today. And there's no internet back then. So you don't email people. You door to door, you have a ton of experience door to door. And then I want to take it back to today, where we have more accessibility to communication, more accessibility in reaching out to people, either in conferences, either Zoom calls or internet phone calls, FaceTime. And it seems like today it could be easier, because you don't have to press hard, go get the actual physical loan application, right? But yet the interest rates went up and everyone's like, I'm only doing like 1 to 4 loans. But here you are in a 9% interest rate environment going up to 11 and still potentially going up to $10 million a month. How does someone in a mindset capacity go in leader, not only in origination and also in leadership, take it to where you just grind it and grit it and just hustle through it?
Well, it's funny. I mean, I just learned always to the harder you work, the more loans you could do, and just keep on working hard and getting back. I think it's so much easier. I mean, everybody's complaining about it. And I don't want to sound like the guy, my day, I used to walk back and forth in the snow. But I will show you one thing I wanted to bring. This is what got me through it in the beginning. This bad boy, I was so ahead of the curve with my technology. That was how my clients got in touch with me. Of course, I had to make sure I was next to my car, because you didn't have that. You couldn't plug in your phone, but that's what we had. And you talk about, you think you got it tough. We used to get the credit reports. And if they ever went off the little rail, I don't know if you talked to people that had that, but the credit reports would come out on this little wheel thing, and it would take a couple of days to get them. So you never knew if your client qualified for a while, but if it ever came off that little digits, it would just make a big mess. It wouldn't even be a printout. So we had it was insane. And we had to like handwrite everything. Everything was, so we had to hand deliver and hand sign everything. You couldn't go in the mail with it. So finally we got to like 93. We were doing the same kind of volume again 93, 2000. I've gone through a whole bunch of these cycles, but to now to be able to sit there on your phone, be on a ski lift, say, oh, your closing documents are there for your client. You hit a little button and sign it. It's just so simple. And my clients don't have to try to track me down on that. They actually can reach me and not, because I never gave out my cell number because it was so expensive to call on that thing. It was, I think it was $1 a minute. So, I mean, I couldn't, so it got crazy. But to answer your question now, I think we have all the technology in the world, but it also, we also have all the, we have a lot more competition. You know, you've got all the servicers that want to, they've gotten really smart and really good at retaining their servicing. And so that's a big challenge for all of us, I think.
Yeah, I think competition is definitely the most overlooked part of it. The attention, the eyeballs, when I hear stories. I also find it very interesting. The 90s are like the lost time. So like we have a lot of guests on here that talk about their venture in the 80s. They get to some point in the early 90s, and then you don't hear from, you know, you don't hear from them very often. I was watching the Kevin Costner Beautiful Day of Christmas about if the birth of Christ. And he talks about, you know, Jesus's time in Egypt, sort of the same. You don't really hear much. I think that's, or maybe no, maybe when he went to Nazareth, but like him growing, you don't hear much about that. I feel like that's a lot for the 90s because, and I just want to, I'm doing a segue to point out, I mean, you were an advisor for Sue Woodward's, like I think
the mortgage, the mortgage guide.
You were doing trainings and nationally.
Barry Abib,
but like Barry Abib, Todd Duncan, Scotsman's Guide. These all ring, and maybe they were before, but to me, these all stories I know about them like 2004.
Yep. Mortgage Originator Magazine, Mom. Yep.
So. So like what goes on from 93? Oh, it's, and so you're a top originator. We can get in later how family sort of determined your current route versus getting the big team and trying to Scotsman's Guide it every year, right? But 93 to 2004, let's say, the internet comes around. Like now that Mike said it, was that the difference? Like it used to be a lot more door to door and nobody wanted to do door to door. So if you actually worked hard and were comfortable, less competition, people didn't mind sending emails and building websites. So that's why all of a sudden it got harder. Or like what?
Oh, it's funny because the email just kind of started in like 92, 93. So we really didn't have, but it was busy then too, because we had another refi boom. It seems to happen every 5 years or so. We're overdue. We're going to have a big one again. And so, but it was 93. You know, we went through 86, 87, and then 92, 93. And then, you know, again, we had like 98 and then 2000 started one. And then it got huge. 2003 was probably one of the biggest years we had. But by then, we were able to finally use computers and laptops and actually take the loan application. Well, we would still, I would do it over the phone. I was still handwriting loan applications right up until, you know, until Encompass probably became, you know, a web based type of thing. We could do it online, but I would still handwrite all my applications right up until probably 2012, maybe even longer than that. So I was always still doing the old school. And I learned that, I remember the Sandler Sales Institute. I don't know if you remember that guy.
Yeah.
That was the first training I got. And I'll never forget, like he said, you know, you talked about how you know, if you're sitting in a doctor's office and you're like, oh, this is, I got things to do. I can't believe I'm, you know, sitting here. This is, you're sitting in your, and the doctor comes in and you're like, come on, how long is this going to take? Then he puts up the chart. He's like, oof. You're like, wait a minute. Now, could I die? You know? So he said, what you want to do is you don't want to have your clients think they're going to die, but you've got to get them a little worried about stuff. And then you've got to be the aspirin. Like they'll do it. So I guess, you know, what was their biggest pain point? And it was always, to me, it was closing costs. People hate closing costs. Like, why not pay all these closing costs? So I learned early on, I'm just going to pay for all their closing costs. And I've done the no point, no closing. And so that to me made my life really easy. And they would just call up and we just do it every time the rate would drop a half a point.
For context, John, if you now the no cost loan and or the no point, no fee or the reduction of costs is almost commonplace. But if we can go back in time again, let's talk about, for example, like we have a mortgage coach today. We have a lot of different options that we can actually create options for. But if you go back before even mortgage coach, you had to be able to say, okay, well, you know, before it was like, okay, this is your loan. And if you were doing like a loan with HFC or beneficial, it was like 4 points, 10 points, right? And so what did you do as a part of the sale in order for you to create the different types of options, and what was your mindset in creating that for your client base?
Well, I mean, the beginning in 86, there was only like the 2 points, and they went to 0.87. I'm like, all right. And then I did the math on this, and then 91, 92 hit. And, you know, I was averaging maybe 30, 40 million a month. Then I realized if I didn't charge them closing, and I stopped charging points, but then I started actually paying for the closing costs in the 90s, because then my $30 million clients would then turn and just refinance again. Now it's 60 million. Then it'd be 120 million. And they'd tell all their friends about that. I didn't pay any closing costs. So I worked a lot. I just worked with basically financial planners and accountants. And I would get in with Fidelity, and they would tell their clients about doing the 0.0 closing and Ameriprise the same. And then I would just sit there and go into an office and just write loan after loan after loan. And then they would tell all their friends about it and their clients. And that I was doing this without doing a lot of real estate business. Cause it was, when I got into the business, there was a lot of older bankers that were, you know, they'd make fun of me. Oh, you don't want to go with me. You know, he doesn't even show up at the office kind of thing. And I just realized that working with financial planners, it was a lot easier. So I'm kind of a dinosaur that way too. I'm not huge on, I have really good friends that are real estate agents and I work with them, but that's not where my main business has ever originated from. It's from my clients and their kids and their referrals.
As far as you said, all the good years, like the refinance rates come back. There's obviously crises too. I don't know this one, if this one counts as one or it's just really bad times, but what makes a crisis harder as an originator for you? Or, you know, maybe a leader, like a branch manager or maybe even an owner, which crisis do you think really stuck out as the one you'd never want to see again?
Well, the one that I still remember, my financial planner calling me and he's like, John, did you hear that Fannie Mae just went bankrupt? And it was like July of 2008. I'm like, no. And I was driving to Storyland with my kids. No, to Santa's Village. And then you get to that certain point where there's no cell coverage when you're getting like Wildcat. And I'm like, oh, my kids are like, Dad, I'm like, this could be really bad. You know, Fannie Mae just went bankrupt. Like, how does that happen? And so that one was a little tough to worry about. But then, you know, I think that's when the rates, really the Fed started stepping in and doing quantitative easing. And they did that in 2009, then 2010, where they would come in and start using, you know, kind of monetary policy to help our rates. And sometimes they'd always stay too long, but you know, or too early. And this time they've stayed too long. I think they're just afraid of this one is probably the most painful, to be honest. That was a short pain, but it got really busy again right after that. I think this one's probably the longest period that I've seen where it's a different world. And they always say it's not different, but this time it is different, where you don't have a lot of inventory, and especially on the East Coast, you know, there's not a lot there. Home prices have gotten a little bit out of hand, though they always seem to be expensive. And I just think that we need to see rates come down a little bit, but I think they're just hesitant because of what happened, you know, after 2002, 2003, when the market, just the rates went up, the inflation got to 9%. But I really think we're going to see rates really start to improve, which will also then cause more people to buy homes and that whole vicious cycle again.
Yeah. How do you keep people through ebbs and flows, right? You have a refi boom, all of a sudden, all of our clients and borrowers are like, I want things done yesterday. Or when rates go up, everyone's freaking out going, I don't know. But I mean, money's not emotional, people are. So how do you keep people calm through these ebbs and flows so that you can keep your origination business constant?
Well, I think I joked about it in 86, but we had, I think it was the first person that ever wrote 100 million was this guy, Fran Lord from Northeastern Mortgage. I don't even know if he's still doing mortgages, but they said, what's your one piece of advice? And he said, you know, a locked loan is a closed loan. And so I'm like, wow, that does make sense, because it's always the loans you don't lock that are the ones that you just have to worry about. But so when you do a 0.0 closing cost loan, even with a purchase, and I would do it for purchase refis, all my clients get that option. So if the rates are coming down, I'm like, this is exactly why we did this type of a program, so that when the rates come back down in 6 months or 8 months, we can just simply refinance you. And you didn't pay me $6,000, $7,000, $8,000. Closing costs are getting even more expensive now than ever with credit reports and everything else. So I'm like, you're not paying this upfront fee that you're never going to see the difference of. It's, you know, it's usually anywhere from 36, I'll be right. It takes at least 36 to 54 months to pay back your closing costs. And I've got 3 years to be right with my clients. I'm going to be right. It's just a matter of time. So that's how I keep them. I say, you know what? If rates go up, I'm like, this is why we locked you in. Rates go down, I go, this is exactly why we did the no point, no closing. So it's a perfect vehicle for my clients.
You can't lose. Either way you win, no, and you always get a Christmas CD. Like,
yeah. What else? And who knew I'd start looking like Santa? So, you know, it's like...
Yeah, like somebody fell on your roof and you had to sign the clause. Okay, yeah. On that note, great episode. We're halfway through. We're going to hear if we couldn't be possible without some of our sponsors. And these technologies are ones that we get behind here. They're certainly ones that large lenders are using to show. And John said the perfect story early on. Loan officers recognize when there's good technology to make them better and when they're in the stone ages. One example is there's a lot of archaic pricing product eligibility engines that have been unable to break through for a long time. And so you have a longer, older incumbent. And now you can see why over 50, and the number could be higher, companies are changing this year alone into Poly, the new pricing product eligibility engine, one of our sponsors. They're not in the video. Let's see some of the videos and hear some of the audio of some of our great sponsors. And we'll be back on the other side.
Verifying income for all your applicants means you need roughly 23 different vendors and waste hours and hours of your team's time. But with Truework, it's just a single place for all your income verification needs, so you get the most advanced VOIE solution. Truework combines all major verification methods into a single, easy-to-use platform to give you a completion rate of 75%, cutting your cost by up to 50% and getting real results for your team. Truework, your one-stop shop for income verification. Click, verify, repeat.
Where the company can do the configurability. So we have no code on this, so they can go in their settings, they can set it up all the way down to the loan officer if they want to. We also have a customer support team that's assigned to each account. If they want, they can overhaul everything if they wanted to. They have a new product, especially dynamic apps. With dynamic apps, we can fit multiple. We can fit the Fannie Freddie loans. We can new construction, one-time close, HELOCs. You know, whatever those workflows are, they can design that workflow for each individual app. Now, what's going to take it to the next level is the AI and the OCR piece.
Cyber and wire fraud. Can you afford the risk? Today's automation and technology-based trends demand solutions to fraud threats. Funding Shield provides lenders and investors real-time transaction-level verification, certified wire fraud protection to protect loss of funds at closing due to cyber-based and other threats. We help improve your bottom line through fraud prevention, risk management, and validating the parties and documents involved in mortgage closings. Prevent fraud and theft on your closings.
All right, we're back. You know, I don't want to run out of time here, John. I will say that. So you're back here. You're in a world where Beverly, Tewksbury, do you think your success was a product of a vibrant housing market? You know, it always seems to be steady because there's not much land to build on. There's hospitals and college universities and ocean. Do you think it was because of your ability to train and understand sales from your Mr. Meat background, your Sandler background? Or do you think it was some other, it sounds like your ability to work with maybe financial planners, find a unique referral plan. What is the mix there? How much of it is geography? How much of it's rate? And how much of it is personality?
I think it's all of the above. I don't know about the personality part as far as just working hard and actually taking care of my clients. I mean, I would never do something that I didn't feel was right for my clients. The biggest part of that was, I think, in 2008 when the market collapsed, we would not do a stated income loan where a client would have to state an income on an application and sign it. We just would not allow it. And I lost loan officers over it, but it didn't make sense to me. And so, you know, that part of it, I think, is just, we just were always an ethical that always did the right thing for our clients. We never did anything that would hurt our client. I mean, of course, there's those clients that probably don't deserve the rate lock to be extended or whatever, but I'd rather not make a commission on that loan and know that I'm going to help them or someday help their kids or whatever it might be, even though I might not be the, you know, might not be my fault why they didn't close on time, I never would put that on my client. So, you know, it's just that kind of thing that we always do the right thing for your client, no matter what. I think that's what the biggest success thing is. And I can't be the lowest rate. None of us can be, but I'm not going to be wrong long enough that they'll even know, because I'll get them, you know, the better rate when the rates come down, and it won't cost them anything. So I'm not up against I hate to put it like Rocket. They have a great program, but their closing costs are insane. I mean, you're looking at 15,000 in fees. I'm like, oh my God, like how could you do that to a client knowing that these rates are going to come down? And they're like, well, how do you know they're going to come down? I'm like, well, you know, history is not going to repeat itself, but it'll rhyme. I mean, these rates always come down in a 4 to 5 year cycle that you'll never recoup the closing costs you paid. So that's just doing the right thing. And I think working with financial planners and accountants, people that their clients, you know, have skin in the game, have, you know the power of money. That's what I just love, the velocity of money and how to use the rule of 72 and building wealth for my clients. That was my biggest thing. I was always about, you know, they're always like, how are we going to afford this home? And I'm like, you know, it's like when you had your first kid, you know, you didn't think you'd be able to have the kid and everything is fine. When you buy that first house, I've done so many of my clients' loans that I'll do their loan again as a refinance a year later, and they're going to have just as much money in the savings as they had before. They haven't adjusted their spending. Well, they did, but they didn't realize it, because now you've got this giant kid and you don't realize, you don't go out as much, but you don't notice it. You spend what you make, no matter how much money you make. I think all of us that are originators know that. We make seven figures and we don't have any more at the end of the year than when we made these type of years. Sometimes I have less from those big years. So it's all about, you know, building wealth with real estate and just being at the, working with the right clients and doing the right thing. I think that's the, what I've done for years. I don't know what else to do.
Did you ever, there was a time like when I was originating retail originations, my favorite adjustable rate lender was actually Chevy Chase, because they offered like 1.0 margins versus originators who would go and earn as much as they could off like 5, 6, 7 margins. And those are times, and that's the time where the originator gets a chance to really show their education in the mortgage industry. But what do you think now about adjustable rate mortgages for those who are like, well, I'm not sure rates are going to take off, I'm not really sure what's going on? Was there ever a time you thought there's just too much product, it's just not worth it?
Well, I just remember somebody from World Bank showed me the option arm thing, and he came out with a brochure. It was more pages than my frozen meat thing was. I'm like, if I can't understand this, there's no way my clients can understand how this option arm works with a different, like you talked about, with the 3.0 margin or the one. And funny thing is, those probably ended up being the cheapest mortgages when the market collapsed and the rates, you know, went to zero. But by then, everybody else, you know, the problem was that these people had no money to put down and they had no income. So they, doesn't matter what you say, it doesn't matter if the payment was zero, they couldn't afford it. They couldn't afford it the day they got the mortgage, which to me was a problem. But as far as a regular longer term adjustable, I love them. It kills me that they kind of went away when COVID hit. I mean, that was kind of a casualty of COVID. I was always putting my clients into a 7 or a 10 year arm. And then when the 30 year fixed would line up, I would just put them into a 30 year fixed. I have no problem with that. As long as you can pay the closing costs with it. That the one issue I have with a lot of the arms is that they don't allow above par pricing to be able to cover their closing costs. So to me, yes, you're getting this to get out of it, yet you're paying me closing costs. So I think you'd be better off with it, you know, and they're pretty close to the fixed rate right now. So if you're going to save a half a point, but have to pay me closing costs, there's still that 30 month break even that I think I'm better off charging them a little bit higher rate without the closing costs and give them a credit. That's my thought on that, but I can't wait until they become more mainstream again. It was my favorite product was the 7 and 10 year arms. I really believe in it, because I don't think you're going to be in a loan over 7 to 10 years.
This episode will resonate a lot with loan officers, because it's something they really lean into, right? I always say this, but there's many loan officers, myself included, that wanted to be called some sort of financial planner type. There was an insecurity of the loan officer name, you know, post financial crisis, right? I'm a financial advisor, right? Like, put that in my title.
Bachelor show and everything else at the time, you know?
If you were a bachelor, not a loan officer, financial advisor. So I your advice versus get on TikTok and get a ring light is something that is very attractive to them. They definitely understand how to read yield. and they're hearing from a legend. I mean, you talk to somebody that back in the day, Tim Brahim, if I said that right, you know, only beat you by four loans one year, 676 to 672. You also have I think one of your magical stories, you kind of hinted on this, on how consumers with family and they adjust with having the kids. But you had, Matthew, what was it, right after your best month? So I think you had 124 loans in 1 month, $32 million in August of 2004. And you have a kid, so you got to be walking around at night with, and it's like, do I outsource this? Is this the end of my, am I selling my soul, or am I, you know, a Scotsman's guide, or what am I doing here? So what was that like, teaching people generational health, dealing with
Yeah, that was my epiphany moment. There's so many of us that burn themselves out. I mean, there's few, the number one guy, Sean, he's got it all together somehow, but he wakes up at 5 a.m. and does, and I wasn't that kind of a person. I was an econ major just so I could get to, I would be waking up from my classes when my engineer buddies would be coming back. So it really, you know, it's like, it's, I'm not a 5 a.m. person or whatever they do. But so I bought my son at the time, and it was sad because he had gotten Lyme disease, and it really scared me. I didn't know what he had, and it turned out it was Lyme disease. And he was just going to preschool at the time. And so I bought a convertible, an older convertible that I could drive with him that didn't have an airbag, so I wouldn't like knock him out of the car if we got in an accident kind of thing. And I said, every Friday, we would listen to the, I don't know if you remember that movie, Night's Tale, with Heath Ledger. And it was awesome. But so they have a favorite quote in that movie, and it's called, "Days like these are far too rare to cheat." And so I'm like, Matt, this is, you know, I'm going to pick you up every Friday and we'll, you know, from school, and we'll ride in the convertible and we'll listen to this, you know, all the different songs. It was all Queen, everything. So it was an awesome friggin', you know, they do like all these rock and roll songs to these knights jousting. It's a really good movie if you haven't seen it. But anyway, I didn't pick him up that first Friday after I did that huge month, and he's sitting at the door. And I'm like, "Now, Matt," he goes, "Where were you, Dad?" I'm like, I just finished closing the biggest month, like you mentioned. It was, you know, it was 132, some crazy, 124 loans, $32 million. And I'm like, "I've never done anything like this before." And he looked at me and he goes, "Dad, so you cheated." So I'm like, "Oh my God, this is like crushing me." So I'm like, "You know what? It's not worth risking I don't care if I do, you know, $300 million. I'd already done, you know, the $180 million years, $160 million. I'm like, it's not worth losing my family over. So I didn't, you know, it really affected me, and it made it so that I realized that yes, it's important to make sure I take care of my clients as much as I can, but I'm not going to sit there and risk my whole family for it. And I think a lot of people in this business do, and it's a mistake.
Something that I've mentioned a few times in a few of the shows: when your values are clear, your decisions are easy. You know, when you're focused on your family, then you figure, well, do I take this new loan app, or do I have my assistants do it? And you go, well, I made a commitment to my son, so here we go. I'm going to commit to my son, and then I will talk to my customer, because my value proposition to the customer is still a customer service. Let the assistant open it, and then we can figure out how to really have the customer feel as best as they can. So, how does that for you on a regional basis? Would want to help people in the community as an originator, but then when did you start going from just local to national and thinking, this is the time where I can now also give back to the community, going to national conferences like the MBA or Lenders One or whatever?
I was fortunate to work for Jim Pertel in the business, and our president's club would be to see like Barry Habib. You know, that was or we'd go to Steve Marshall's events. We'd go to all the mortgage banker events. One, they're a lot of fun. Like the one in Newport's the best. And that's where I'd meet Mike, and he got me the Green Monsters the first time I tried those when we were watching a Red Sox game in Washington, D.C. And I got to meet him at a bunch of these different conferences, which they really are a lot of fun. But you learn a lot of things. I'm the guy that would just sit there and be writing notes and just trying to learn, because it's just amazing. You just pick, you're going to pick one thing out of these things that's going to help you get better, and you can always get better. I just remember I heard Mike Ditka talk about it one time, and he was on some where he would go, and sorry, Bill Belichick was also part of the speaking thing, and I went to see him, who was an amazing speaker, by the way. You'd be surprised how good he is in person. But so Dicka was like, you know, you go to these things and you get like your neck is like a muscle or a cord. And the more you hear these things, the stronger that cord gets and the more you learn. And so I just really think the more you learn, the more you're going to earn. And just, you learn different things every time. I'm on like everything. Loan Atlas, Mortgage Coach. You know, I love Tabrasa. I'm on, you know, Mortgage Highway. I spend so much. And every time they say, you know, it's just one loan, but I'm like, oh my God, I got to write a lot of loans just to cover all these things I belong to. So it keeps me motivated.
I find, you know, we're in an industry where we build generational wealth for the families that we build it for. And so I guess I have two questions. One relating to that, you must have a story where someone came back with their kid now ready to buy a home, or their nephew or their niece. But I want to have you follow up with this. You know, you have Matt, so you actually have a purpose for a succession plan if you want it, on what you're going to do with all these clients, right? I think there's a lot of loan officers that, you know, maybe their kids are five. And so, like, are they going to force that kid into taking over the book of business? Do they actually really have a book of business? And are they pushing hard for something that when they retire is sort of poof, gone? And maybe they should not cheat every day unless they have a plan of what they're actually building for. So kind of two part, what story about generations coming back to you and proving you build generational wealth. And then what are the challenges of loan officers in their, what they're building was a generation, the occupation.
Well, it kind of ties into, you'd ask me how I got also to get away from sitting. So I had a client that he was one of the last clients that, that I actually met in the house with, because I had no choice. My kids were all in vitro. So if you miss the days you've given them a shot, I don't know if it works, you're not going to have a kid. So I had twins. And I went to his house, one of my favorite clients. And at the time he had twin 13-year-old daughters, and they started I thought they were going to kill each other. I mean, I've never seen anything like that in my life. Like they were swearing at each other and ripping, cause one had worn the other one's sweater. And then they ripped the sweater in half. And he's like, so I hadn't yet had I didn't know what I was having for twins. I can still remember him saying, he looked at me right in the eye and he said, pray one's a boy. So I'm like, all right. So we're doing the ultrasound the next day. And he was literally the last client I did a face-to-face with, because I just almost missed getting home and giving the shots and all that. My wife's like, never again. So I learned how to do loans over the phone and all of that. But so we did the ultrasound. First one, a girl. I'm like, second one, boy. I'm like, thank goodness. So not that I love both my son and my daughter, but just to have not the same growing up. So go back 15 years later, I did their loan, both of them, and they both bought homes together, and I did both their houses. So they're my, you know, so I've done that so many times where I've helped my clients' kids, and I joke about it, but I start doing the grandkids, and I think I'm going to have to probably hand over the calculator to Matt. But
Philip Rivers is making it cool again.
I know. I'm thinking I can do it. If he can do it, I can do it. But man,
John, so you're teaching the loan officers around the entire country. Social media, before social media was actually cool. But what is one thing that you would want to teach an originator today, or one lesson at least, that would remind them, that they could remind themselves what it is that keeps them going as an originator to stay in the profession and to stay the course?
I think, you know, adapting and learning to embrace technology. I mean, I'm going to be out there. I mean, you probably saw, I was out there skiing and kind of try to get up on my deck and I knocked myself into the side of my ski place. But I mean, you don't have to do serious. And I belong to a Forward Academy where they do Neil Dingra, and he does these, and it's amazing. I learned that from Barry Habib, where he does, you know, you want to do some informational stuff, but it really, people want to see what you are. You want to build a personal brand through technology. It's so, and it's free. It's like, you know, people, we went to when we were at the Synergy One, they had a, you know, Power Up sales rally in Denver, and they had a speaker there, and these guys do a ton of volume, but he's like, you know, you guys are, you'll do a video and you'll get 200 views and you're like, oh, that stinks. But meanwhile, you're in a room, if you could have 200 people in front of you at all times, he goes, that's how many are in this room right now. And imagine if this is your audience you're getting for free. You know, people don't realize that you can, you know, I think younger loan officers should embrace the social media stuff and start using it and doing what you guys are doing with these podcasts. This is my first podcast I think I've ever done. So I feel like I'm a dinosaur, but it's amazing how you can do this and meet and get yourself in front of so many people and build a brand. We have those guys, the Mortgage Dads. They work for a company. They're a riot, but I'd say like 80% of the stuff they do is just goofing around. And so I'm all for that. But you can, you know, they do give some good information. It's one of my clients right now that's going through, he lost everything. His wife has got Parkinson's. So they took away, I'd give him a $300,000 refinance cash out. We didn't do the right it wasn't my fault at the time, but I should have suggested going to a probate attorney because he didn't. She got Parkinson's. They took the $300,000 that he had for his retirement. And I'm now able, you know, having to do a loan for him right now where he has nothing, but it's just, you've got it. So I did a video, one of the more serious ones, on just how important it is to set up a will, a trust, and probate and get that set up. So then in case something happens to one of your, they could still be alive and you'd lose everything, you know? So it's just, that is so important that we could change, not only help build generational wealth, like you mentioned. I mean, Mortgage Coach is another perfect example. I always recommend, and there's a way you can show what the investments grow and not to, but I took the $300 I saved from one of my first refinances and just gave it to my financial planner. When my kids went to go to school, and I had three in college, that $300,000 had turned into $300,000 when they went to college. And it's money I didn't even know I was, it eventually just came out of my account. But had I just did not put it with a financial planner, it would have been gone. So that's the thing you've got to, as a loan officer, we can really make a difference with people's lives. And not now, but even 15 years from now. So that's where I think we got to be good.
I don't think that originators today even understand some of the software that financial advisors use. For example, like if they understood even what Redtail is, Redtail is a origination software, is like a origination software for financial planners. And if they knew that and they could go, oh yeah, we can go over to Right Capital, and then Right Capital directly goes into Y charts and that tells you about the markets and tells you about what's going on. I don't think enough originators actually understand that financial services side of how is it that the financial advisor is using technology today to reach back to their clients. And then how do they use that information so that the originator can say, oh, this is how the advisor is now tracking people. And this is how, I can also sync our technology with their technology and with the information that's readily available today, create more opportunities for their business. I think that, if we were to go back and say, hey, you know, Mr., you were working with financial advisors, CPAs, estate planning attorneys before it became cool. And now that it is cool, we actually don't even know enough. Bear Habib has been really adamant on doing, on teaching originators how to do that, but they really haven't caught on. They haven't got it. That's a term that a lot of people use. So if there was a someone that's brand new, like you were back in 1986, and they're coming into the business today, what is a story that you would tell them that, and is this the same story that you would tell your son?
Well, I'm telling my kids, it's amazing how even a $300 savings. So it's like people are, you know, when you go to help someone refinance, they're saying, well, it's only $300, but it's just, I tell them the story of how that $300 turns into to being able to afford college for my three kids, you know? So, and it's just money that if you don't do something with your savings, and they always say, I never was an advocate of a 15-year mortgage. So I said, you know, look to the longer, and there's, and I have a book, and it's funny, I went to look for it. I think Matt hit it again, but it's Die With Zero. Awesome book. And the guy, it's not that you don't have any money when you die. It's that you have enough money to pay off your mortgages. I told him I'm leaving this earth with the big, and I tell this to my clients. I always tell all my clients this, that I'm leaving this earth with the biggest mortgage I can and let my kids friggin' worry about it, because I'd rather have the money that I can then use, the financial freedom of having that money saved somewhere else. And that's what you have to learn, is that the power of that rule of 72 and having money. And I tell all of them my Warren Buffett quote, that, you know, if money doesn't work for you while you sleep, you're going to work until you die. And I want to work till I die, but I don't want to have to work till I die. So, I mean, that's the biggest thing right now, is to let them know how you can help build wealth, build real estate. What is it? It's 40 times, the people that buy a home are 40 times more wealthy, you know, build wealth 40 times faster than ones that are renting. And, you know, that it's just incredible, that it's just the best vehicle to have out there to use that and then to leverage that and then take that money that you can save from refinancing and all of that to build your future when we have kids and they're in college. It's just, we can make a difference in everybody's life. And I think it's not just doing someone's loan and trying to get $100 million and I did 1,000 loans. It should be more than that. And that's where I think a new loan officer we have to be more than just writing loans because we're going to get replaced.
You talk about new loan officers, just going back to the other question I had about legacy and what do all these, I think the average age is 54 of a loan officer.
Jeez, I should be retired soon then. Go ahead.
What do you think should be the plan for the alumni class of yours and even the ones younger than you? Like, what should they be passing it to their company? Should they be passing it to somebody they know? Should they be mentoring it to pass it? Or do they just let the candle kind of go out and know they did a great job while they were here in the industry?
That's kind of a sad. That's what I felt. You know, I actually feel as I was going to happen. So I want my, and the problem is I love this business. I think you've got to love writing loans. I mean, it's a certain amount, there's a certain kind of person that loves doing this. And I don't know what else we could possibly do, but I tell them there's nothing else that you're going to be able to get the freedom. I mean, I was at the time, even, you know, 4 or 5 years ago when COVID hit, we were making more money. I said, I am now making more money than one of my clients that's a rocket scientist and the other client that was a brain surgeon put together. My income was higher than both of their incomes put together at that time. Of course, you know, they're still making that kind of income. And, you know, we know what happens to the mortgage industry, but there's no other. And I got to see all my kids' soccer games. I got to travel. You get so much freedom in this business. I don't think there's anything else that's going to allow this, but I really think it is something that I'd have a tough time telling, you know, Matt's got my pipeline to help me and my clients and everything, but a new person coming in, it's going to be tough because you've got AI, if you're just going to be a mortgage loan officer and write loans and not do more for your client, you're going to be replaced. We are replaceable, unfortunately.
Is there anything that you wish that throughout your career that you wish you would have learned? Like you're doing it today, but you didn't do it in the 90s or you didn't do it in the 80s or 2000, in the early 2000s. Then you go, you know what? That's really good in the tech space. I like this.
Oh, the tech space, I try to embrace all the new technology I can. But as far as like, I wish I had spent more time actually working with real estate agents because I realize when the refis go away, they're pretty important, you know? And so even now, I mean, I've always done purchase business from my financial planners and all that, but it's not the same as getting a lead from a real estate agent. So that was the part that I really think I could have, but I also think I would have sacrificed my weekends and being able to ski with my kids and stuff because they're a little bit more demanding than my financial planners and my CPAs. As far as the clients go. So I think that's part of me is happy I didn't, but the other part of me feels I could have probably done a lot more business if I had kind of built up that pillar of business. But aside from that, I mean, there's anybody that's not embracing that using this type of stuff, you know, the podcast, the Zoom calls, it's so easy to post a reel. It's crazy. I mean, okay, well, I'm an old man and I can do it. You know, I think it's probably even funnier to see someone like me do it, but. And you don't have to be business. I think that's boring as anything. If you're just going to do videos on, you know, rates and terms and adjustable, I think that's crazy. But we can educate and let them know how important it is to get a probate and get wills set up and put the homes in a trust before one of your spouses gets incapacitated and you could potentially lose your home. I mean, there's a 5-year look back. You've got to start now to do all this type of stuff. So that's where that's my new thing is I'm going to try to joke around with my videos and things, but then try to do what I can to educate my clients in really important pieces of, you know, saving for college and all of the different type of stuff. Because I think that's more, they don't need to hear about no point, no closing and all that kind of stuff.
Thank you. And before we say farewell, John, anything, you get some listeners, maybe they want to work under your wing for a year, work with you or work with Synergy One. Can you maybe tell us just how they can get in touch with you? Why you enjoy getting up every day and, you know, why Synergy One is such a great place or why your office is such a great place and why you're looking forward to the ski season coming up here.
I'm definitely looking forward to the ski season and actually helping. And I've got my son and actually one of my other loan officers here that started. It's funny. He's signed up for a podcast and now uses the same service you did. He did it yesterday. So he's starting to do podcasts. And I think the more we can And I'd love to have people come and work with our office and do that. And, you know, my cell phone's on everything. You can find me in S. John Murray, you know, online and all of that. I don't think there's a lot of S's in there, the S. John Murray part. But I'd love to help, or just I'm whatever I can do to try to help our industry, I'd love to. So if you have any questions, call me with stuff. But Synergy One is the most amazing. I mean, their technology now, I haven't even tapped into some of it, but it's that we have 13 different GPTs that we can use for different. It's unbelievable. I mean, I talk to my daughter. You can literally, you can say, you know, I want to put in $400 a month in a 401k. This is the average return. What will I expect in 7 years, in 10 years? And it'll answer those questions for you. We don't need to have any fancy calculators or things. Just use AI. And and we have one thing I'm still waiting on. We have this person called Casey that will call my clients, and she's an artificial. And she sounds like a human. So at some point they're probably going to use our voices, which I don't think we will, but I think that would be a mistake, because I think you'll know it's not quite. Whenever they answer the phone and call me S, I know it's an AI person, but it really is. This is the best industry in the world. And if I can do anything to help someone, I would love to do it. This is what I think now this is what I need to be doing, instead of just trying to write 100 million every year. That gets exhausting.
Well, we heard your story. You definitely pivot quick into the greater decisions that make more whole in your life. So that could be one. You spreading this message more, and I think our audience is very thankful for it.
Thank you for joining us on this journey into the heart of mortgage innovation. Remember, every mortgage has a story, and we're here to help you write yours. If you enjoyed today's insights, please subscribe, share with your network, and connect with us on social media. Until next time, keep pushing the boundaries and uncovering the stories that drive our industry forward.